it's matured into an objectively good-looking man. Sometimes I wonder how many other girls he... If I had stayed Josie, stayed in the U.S., I would accuse Billy, take my place in the Me Too movement, or not. I've never been particularly brave, or good, or wise, or forgiving. The knot where Billy lives in my chest is cold and hard, but the surrounding tissue burns with hatred for my mother. I thought I'd overcome it, but as Sarah grows, I see so clearly how unprotected and vulnerable my mother allowed us to be, and I think, how could she have let that happen to me? What did she think would happen if two little girls were left to wander through the forest of adults, always filling the patio of Eden? Adults who were drunk at the bare minimum, or stoned or coked up. My dad, too, but he was in the kitchen all the time. My mother was always out, mingling. What did she think would happen?
Near morning, the rain begins to taper off, turning into a gentle, soothing background.
Simon snores softly, his big hand on my hip, anchoring me. Down the hall, my children are tucked safely into their beds. This is the family I wanted so desperately when I was a child, and I created it for myself. I've also transformed myself from a lost, drunken wanderer into a woman with purpose, a successful business person. I escaped. Escaped the woman I became after Billy. I took myself back, made myself over, became a woman I am proud of. And I would do it again. 1,000 times, I would do it again.
Chapter 17, Kit. As the storm swirls, I make do with a bunch of apartment-sized tools to make brownies. The act of stirring them, making the specific brownies I love so much, with an ancient recipe taken from the Hershey site, eases the anxious tension in my spine. Being so far from everyone and everything I've known, I feel unmoored, as if the storm could send me flying out into the atmosphere like Dorothy. Oh, Josie, I think, where the hell are you? I feel anxious now that I surfed instead of looking for her. That I avoided the journey. I feel exactly torn in half. I want to find her, but that's going to mean facing a lot that I've buried for a long time. Do I even want to find her, really? Maybe it would be better to let sleeping dogs lie. Except that I have to admit my life is pretty sterile. Maybe finding Josie will help me make peace with everything, give me some space to... what? I don't know, change things. My brownies are ready, and I take them out of the oven, bending my head to inhale the chocolatey, sweet scent as I settle them on the counter to cool. Outside, the storm is working itself up into a fine frenzy, and inside my head, the frenzy is in my thoughts. When a knock sounds at my door, I practically fly across the room. It's Javier. Standing there with a bottle of wine and a box of food.
I was worried about you, he says. Can I come in?
Yes, please. I take the bottle and the box, set them on the counter, and throw my arms around his waist. Leaning into his solid body, for a moment, I can tell he's startled, and I wonder if I should pull away. But I've been feeling so lost and tortured and young. That he feels like a life raft. After the slightest hesitation, his arms circle me.
Are you frightened?
No, I say. Not of the storm. I lift my head. I didn't want to be alone in it.
Nor do I,
he murmurs and kisses me, then walks me backward toward my bed near the window. We fall down together and make love while the storm rages. The air smelling of chocolate and ozone. This time it's different. I find myself slowing down, tasting him, breathing in the scent of his skin, looking at him more carefully. His stomach is slightly soft and very sensitive, and I spend time there, kissing and tasting. His thighs are sturdy, covered with the hair I tried not to look at when he wore slightly more. And he takes his time too, hands touching what his eyes see, my breasts and the sides of my ribs, my neck, which he kisses and kisses and kisses and kisses until I'm squirming and giggling. And then he captures my mouth and slides his fingers between my legs, and I have an almost instantaneous orgasm. Afterward, we lie sprawled and open to the night, covering nothing. It feels lush and intimate, and a ripple of warning moves through me. But there's a built-in limit to this connection. We live on different continents and met on a third. That's enough of a safeguard that I feel comfortable simply being myself. After a while, we get up to make ourselves plates and pour wine into the goblets I find in a cupboard above the sink. It's a little chilly, so we carry it all back to the bed and curl up with the covers over us, propped against the pillows. Outside, the storm rages. Inside, we eat. "Where did you get the tapas?" I ask, popping a roasted, salted pepper in my mouth.
"La olla, where I took you."
"Were you there?"
"We rehearsed there, and when the cyclone blew in, they gave us all plates of food and sent us home."
He plucks an olive from his plate.
"Miguel wanted me to come home with him."
I laugh, touching his foot with mine under the covers.
"What did you tell him?"
I shrug.
"Only the truth, that I worried about you being alone here."
With his long fingers, he plucks out a roll of ham.
"I told him that you were coming to hear me sing and that you promised not to run away this time."
"Your holiday romance.
Is that what you are?"
He cocks his head, looking at me with those dark, dark eyes. In this light, I can see the scars of long-ago acne in the hollows of his cheeks and the network of lines time has woven at the corners of his eyes. For a moment, I'm captured, falling into a cool and fragrant atmosphere that fills the air around us, binds us, but only until I straighten to shake it off. "How long are you staying in New Zealand?"
"I don't know."
He sets his plate aside and takes my free hand, opening the fingers that are slightly clenched. He smooths them flat, revealing the heart of my palm, and strokes the center lightly before he presses his against mine. It is somehow 1,000 times more intimate than all the things we just did to each other. A hitch catches in my throat.
"I think, mi sirenita, that there is more here than a fling."
I keep my gaze on our hands until he touches the tender area beneath my chin. I allow it, allow myself to feel the yearning, the sense of possibility. For 1 minute, or maybe two, or maybe as long as the storm lasts. Seeing my acquiescence, he smiles gently.
"Tell me something you loved as a child."
"My sister," I reply without hesitation. "We had our own little world, just the two of us. It was full of magic and beautiful things."
"Hmm,"
he says, moving his palm lightly over mine.
"What magic?"
"Mountain Dew was an actual magic elixir. Do you know Mountain Dew?" He nods. "There were kitchen fairies and mermaids who moved things around to make the grown-ups crazy."
"Sounds happy," he says.
"That part of it," I agree.
"And your sister, what was she like?"
I take a breath. "Beautiful. Not just pretty, but really beautiful. With this amazing bright light around her all the time. Everyone loved her, but none of them loved her as much as I did." He brings the hand he smoothed up to his mouth, kisses my knuckles.
"You must miss her so very much."
I nod and take my hand back on the pretext of wanting to eat. "Your turn. What did you love as a child?"
"Books," he says with a laugh. "I loved to read more than anything. My father grew angry with me. Javier, you need to run. You need to play with the other boys. Go outside. He lifts a shoulder. I only wanted to lie in the grass and think about other worlds, other places.
What did you read?
Whatever I could find.
He makes a pshhting sound, sends his hand out in a gesture of circles through the air.
Adventure and mysteries and ghost stories, whatever.
You still love reading, don't you?
You don't?
I like to read. I just don't like to work hard to read. I like books that take me away, the same way television or the movies do.
Like what?
I frown and then reach for my phone, where all the books are listed in my reader. Scrolling through it, I say, okay, the past few months I've read two historical romances, a mystery by a woman I like, because I can trust her not to get too dark, and a cooking memoir.
Romance? Are you seeking love, gatita?
No, I say definitively. Passion ruined my family's lives. I make it a practice to avoid it.
Love is not always destructive, he says quietly, and slides a finger up my shin. Sometimes love creates.
I'm unexpectedly caught by something in his voice, a promise I can barely see, shimmering faintly on the horizon, and it scares me enough to throw out a gauntlet. Tell me a time that love didn't destroy what it first created.
He is divorced, clearly not involved with anyone.
In your own life, I add. He nods, stretching out sideways in front of me, close enough to touch my knee. I could press my palms to his shoulder, his head, but I don't. I keep my arms crossed, one hand cradling the wine.
When I was 17, a girl came to our neighborhood. She had the shiniest hair I had ever seen, and pretty ankles, and I could not find my voice to talk to her. But one day, we met at the library, in the very same row. She was looking for the very same book I was.
I'm tempted to brush the hair on his temple away from his face, but I don't. What book?
Stephen King, The Shining, he says, and smiles up at me. You thought it would be Don Quixote, yes?
I smile. Maybe.
We spent so much time reading and talking about reading, and soon we read each other, you know, both of us virgins.
A ping snaps my chest, bringing me a memory of myself at 17, the first time I made love, to a boy I worked with at Orange Julius. James. How I loved him. Javier continues.
With her, I learned about how easy sex can be.
Something in my expression must give me away, because he says,
who taught you that lesson?
It's funny, I was just thinking about him before you came. A boy at school.
See, love found you.
It broke my heart, though.
Sure, he lifts his shoulders. Me too. But you don't die, you just begin again.
He settles his hand on my thigh. I take a sip of wine, aware of the winding promise between us. It feels dangerous and rich. How many times?
As many times as life offers.
A sharp, hard pain stabs my heart. I shake my head. I don't fall in love. His lips quirk. Almost a smile. His fingers brush my knee.
You are falling a little with me?
I smile. Nope.
I see.
His hand curves down the length of my calf, around my heel, and then my instep. I briefly wonder if he thinks my ankles are pretty.
How many times have you fallen in love, Kit?
Only once.
How old were you?
I make a noise, exasperated. That question again. 17.
17, he repeats. 17 is generous and earnest.
A memory of James and me, making love over and over, laughing and eating in that empty apartment, flickers through me.
his long thighs, his tongue on me everywhere. Yes, I whisper. Javier reaches for the buttons of his shirt, which I am wearing over my nakedness. He unfastens the first one, and I let him.
What was his name?
James. He unbuttons two more, and his hand sweeps inside, between my breasts, stroking a line.
You were badly wounded?
I nod, forgetting it all as he opens another two buttons and slides the fabric aside to show my breasts. Immediately, my skin is alive from head to toe, every centimeter of it greedy for him.
Perhaps you can let him go after so many years,
I'm mesmerized by his heavy-lidded admiration as he moves his hand over my shoulders, down the valley between my breasts, his fingers light as he brushes the curves, the tips, my belly, then back up. Maybe, I whisper, and then his mouth follows his hands, and I'm gone. When the storm is at its height, we don swimsuits and head downstairs to the indoor pool. It's very late, and the pool is empty, waiting there in blue splendor for us to dive in. We frolic like dolphins, diving and splashing, and then we both fall to swimming laps, easily and simply, back and forth. I want the water on my body and slip out of my suit, and he smiles and does the same. If anyone comes, there will be ample warning. So we swim naked, with the night blurry beyond rain-spattered windows. The wind whistles and howls, but inside is warm and safe. When we finish, we wrap up in towels and head into the dry heat sauna. Heaven, I say. The heat opens my pores, my body, wafts in waves over my breasts and knees and nose. I would love to have a pool like that, where I could swim whenever I wanted. In my house in Madrid, I have a sauna and a steam shower. Decadent, I open one eye. He's leaning back against the wall, his arms loose, hands resting on his thighs. His body is strong, well-shaped, with that slight extra around the middle that I find so weirdly appealing. It makes me want to climb on him again. Instead, I close my eyes and say, "You must be a rich man."
"Not poor," he agrees. "But you too. You are a doctor."
"I do all right. Housing is stratospheric in California, but the rest is fine." I breathe in the hot air, coughing slightly. "I bought my mom a condo on the beach, and I have a little house. I can be at the beach in 7 minutes on foot."
"Lovely."
"Is your house old?" I ask. I think of Madrid as medieval.
"It's old, but inside it's modern. The kitchen, the bathrooms, the windows. I like plenty of light."
"Mine is old, mission style."
"Spanish," he says with approval, and I smile.
"Yes, our house when we were children was Spanish too, tiled all through in Art Deco."
"Oh," he says, "I like Art Deco."
The words in his voice are somehow lyrical, his tongue making the syllables softer. A shiver walks up my spine, and I open my eyes again. He's looking at me. I'm aware of my shoulders, my thighs.
"Perhaps," he says, "we should return to your room,
Chapter 18. Mari. It's hot and humid the next day, and I'm cranky from too little sleep. Inside Sapphire House, the air is thick, even when I open all the windows, and I make a note to look into what it would cost to add air conditioning. I hate the idea of shutting out the ocean, but with global warming, who knows what the next 30 or 40 years will bring. I'm working on the pantry today, recording the style and variations of all the dishes on the shelves. I always do the inventory before I bring anyone else in. It's tedious work in a way, but it gives me a chance to feel the house itself, to know it intimately before I begin the heavy work of shifting walls and tearing it apart. In some strange way, I feel I owe it to the house itself, honoring it for what it was, what it gave someone else. It's not exactly difficult psychology to know why. Our beautiful old Spanish-style house was devoured by the earthquake. Not only the restaurant and house, the buildings, but everything that was inside them. My mother, Kit, and I scoured the beach for weeks afterward, trying to find things to rescue, but in the end, it wasn't much. Some of our clothes, some battered things from the kitchen. What the earthquake began, the sea and weather completed. I still carry three things from the recovery effort. One is a ring made from a teaspoon, my father's choice for Aiden. Simple, heavy tableware, designed to stand up to harsh commercial dishwashers. It has a little carving of Mount Etna on the end, which I thought unbearably beautiful when I was small. My mother had the ring made for my 12th birthday. The other is a chipped guitar pick that belonged to Dylan, and a t-shirt that belonged to him too. The shirt is as thin and delicate now as flower petals, and I keep it wrapped up and tucked into a drawer. I wore it for years and years, and I never once put it on without thinking of a night the three of us made a big fire on the beach. Kit and I must have been in late grade school, maybe 12 and 10, because Dylan's hair was really long. He must have been 17 or 18. He'd started growing it when he arrived at Eden, and it grew longer every year. By the end, he could braid it into a tail that was halfway down his back. His freak flag, he said, a reference to a song I didn't know. No matter how my father nagged him, he refused to cut it. So I grew my hair out, too. It was already pretty long when he came to live with us, down to the middle of my back. But by the time of the earthquake, when I was 15, I was known for my long, long blonde hair, which swept the top of my thighs. Neither of us wore it loose very often. It tangled and matted so easily he wouldn't believe it. Mine was thicker than his, but his was laced with more colors. Silvery blonde, wheat, a little red, some glittery gold. Mine was just dishwater streaked with sun highlights, but there was power in it. A lot of power. Boys liked it, and even some of the girls on the beach, who were kind of amazed at how long it was. On that night of that summer fire, I took my hair down and started brushing it. Kit took the brush out of my hand and applied herself to my head, which had to be one of the 10 best feelings on earth. She loved brushing my hair and braiding it, and she was both gentle and no nonsense. Do you want it down?
Yeah.
It felt good on my back, which was bare for my bikini. We'd all been swimming in the hot day, and the sand under my butt was still warm. Dylan was shirtless, his t-shirt in a pile on the sand. He almost never let anyone else see him with it off. He even surfed with it on. But he trusted us not to stare at his scars too much. Cinder stretched out beside him, his paws muddy, eyes glinting. Dylan fed the fire until it was snapping and bright orange, then hauled out the bag of stuff he'd brought down from the house kitchen, lining it all up in a tidy row in front of the long, thick tree branch we used for our couch. "We have chocolate bars, marshmallows, graham crackers," he said. "Also, real food you have to eat first. Arancini, ham, and peaches." From the bag, he also brought out Mountain Dews, our favorite, and Kit squealed. "Mama hasn't been letting me drink them." I pinched her thigh, which was thick and solid. "She doesn't want you fat." She slapped my hand away, hard. "I am not fat. I'm athletic."
"Dude," Dylan said in agreement and held up his hand for a high five. "You're perfect just the way you are."
Kit met his palm with a sharp slap, tossed her head, and settled beside him. She was still skin, knees, and grimy fingernails, a kid in every way, whereas I'd learned a lot about getting attention, which I loved, so I dressed for it and cleaned up for it. Nobody really paid much attention to Kit with her crazy hair and square body. But I was jealous of the way she leaned on him, how easy they were with each other. Kit carried around a sense of quiet with her, and it spilled into Dylan in a way I could never match. You could almost see his red aura turning a soft blue the minute she came anywhere near him, as if she carried a magic spell that calmed him down. His hair was back in a braid. "You want me to take your braid out and brush your hair?" I asked.
"Sure."
Eagerly, I picked up the brush and squished through the sand to kneel behind him. Kit scowled at me. It was her thing to brush our hair. I ignored her. Tugging the rubber band from his braid, I loosened it with my fingers. It was cool and soft and still a little damp in places. Running the brush through it felt good, watching it ripple under the bristles and straighten. It was all the way down to the middle of his back, where a particularly bad scar twisted over his spine. I touched it with the tips of my fingers. What's this one?
Right in the middle?
He sat with his arms looped around his knees. His hair skimmed his shoulder blades, fell forward in drifts toward his elbows.
That's a scar from a sword I got and a jewel with Long John Silver.
I traced the wormy pink shape of it, end to end, for the first time realizing that something else had happened to him. For real. He turned to look me in the eye, and there was a pain there I'd never seen. It was like a window had opened into a hell I never wanted to visit.
That's as real as it gets, Grasshopper.
My heart hurt like somebody had shoved a sword through it, and I put my palm on his face. I wish I could kill them.
It wouldn't do any good,
he rasped, but he pressed my hand into his face. And for the first time, I thought maybe there was somebody on the planet who knew what I knew, that a smiling face didn't always mean well. Somebody hurt him, just like somebody hurt me. I also knew the exact moment he would shatter if I didn't shift the mood. I grabbed a fistful of his hair. We're twins, I said, and tied my hair to a hank of his. We all laughed before the knot slipped out. But something changed. He tossed me the t-shirt.
You'll get cold.
Vaguely, I heard Kit say, What about me? I'll get cold too. As I pulled the t-shirt on over my head, smelling Dylan-ness all around me, against my skin. That was when he broke out his guitar, and while we ate peaches and s'mores, he started to play the folk songs he taught us to sing. We joined in, Kit with more gusto than tone, but I fancied myself a pretty good singer, and I tried to weave my voice into the main line of Dylan's bass. His speaking voice was raspy and low, so nice to listen to, but his singing voice was deep and clear, so rich you could almost drink it out of the air like honey. We sang a bunch of camp favorites, then moved into the ballads. I loved the moody, sad, violent ballads Dylan had taught us. He loved playing and singing them, and tonight there was something magical in the air, as if the sparks of the fire were turning to fairies who danced around us. Kit felt it too. She moved close enough to press her bare arm into mine as we sang Mary Hamilton, and a Civil War ballad that was Kit's favorite, The Cruel War, and one of my favorites, Tam Lin, which I thought could have been written for Dylan himself. As we warmed up, his voice wound around the fire and through both mine and Kit's, and we sang like we were on stage somewhere. Overhead, the stars burned bright, and the waves rolled in eternally, and if we could have just stayed right there forever, everything would have been okay. Kit said, You should be a singer, Dylan. Nobody is better than you. He laughed.
Thanks, kitten, but I just like being here with you guys.
As the fire burned down, we spread out a big blanket on the sand, pulled our pillows out of the tent, and stretched out under the vast sky. Light spilled down the hill from Eden, along with music and the sound of voices. I was sleepy as Kit and I took our places next to Dylan, who flung an arm out in either direction so we could scoot up close. The two of us girls spread an open sleeping bag over our bodies and snuggled in, one head on each shoulder. It was our ritual, and had been for years and years now. By then, he'd been with us for 5 or 6 years and was woven completely into our lives. Often, all three of us would fall asleep, only to wake up and stagger into the tent one by one. Tonight, the Perseids were shooting their way across the galaxy. For a while, Kit pointed to one and then another, and chattered about the distance the stars traveled and how many there were and all sorts of other facts. Until she trailed off and fell asleep, just like that. Dylan and I just lay there and watched the sky. It was perfect. He shifted so that Kit was more comfortable in her pillow, but when he came back down again, he patted the spot I liked on his shoulder and I happily slipped back to my place. He lit a joint, and the smoke made shapes against the night. It would have been impossible to be happier than I was right there, with Dylan and my sister close by, the stars overhead. Nothing to worry about. Dylan smelled of salt and perspiration and a sharp note of something that belonged just to him. His voice, low and quiet, rolled into the night.
I'll tell you about the Long John Silver Scar if you tell me something.
I tried to pretend I didn't know what he was going to ask, but my body turned into a board. What?
Did something happen to you a couple of summers ago?
No. I said the word in a tone of voice that made it sound like he was stupid for asking. Why would you even ask that? He took another toke, blew it out, and I reached for the smoke as it wafted over the stars, cutting the sky in two pieces, just like my life, before and after.
Maybe I was wrong.
I tried to let it go, but the question brought back the acid in my stomach, the taste of his hands over my mouth, the way he hurt me. But I lied. You were.
Okay,
Dylan said mildly, and pointed up at a trio of falling stars. I watched it. I told you. Now you have to tell me. It was a belt buckle. Impossible to stop the sudden intake of my breath. Dude. He scratched my head in a way I liked.
Long time ago, Grasshopper.
But now I felt bad that he told me the truth and I didn't tell him. I tried to think of a way to say it that didn't sound disgusting, and I couldn't find one. A man did stuff to me. This guy made me take off my clothes. This guy said he'd kill Cinder if I didn't do what he said.
You know you can tell me anything, right?
I twitched my shoulders, moving away from him, sitting up so I could look out to the ocean. On the far horizon, light caught and made the edge glow. I guess.
You guess?
He sat up too, his arms hanging loosely over his legs.
I swear you can tell me. Anything.
Chewing on my lip, I looked over at him. His loose hair was getting tangled now, little loops sticking up here and there. You have to swear, like, completely and totally swear that you won't tell and you won't make me tell. He touched his chest, hand over his heart.
I promise.
But even then, I couldn't figure out how to say it. A wind kicked up and made me shiver, but I couldn't say it. As I was struggling to find the words, Dylan said,
Was it one of the guests?
I nodded, weaving my fingers together, a panicky feeling in my chest.
Did he touch you?
Again, I nodded, but my lungs felt strange, and I suddenly felt like I couldn't breathe. I tried to suck in air, but I couldn't, and I turned to Dylan with wild eyes, my breath stuck in my chest like my throat was broken in half.
Hey, hey.
He moved closer, took a drag off the joint, and gestured me closer.
Breathe in as I breathe out.
I leaned in as he blew out the smoke, and the acrid sting of it hit the back of my throat.
Good, he said, blowing the rest away from my face. Hold it as long as you can.
Immediately, my breath started moving again. It was like the booze I sipped out of glasses when nobody was looking, or they were going back to the dishwasher, or someone thought it was cute that I should have a sip of a martini. I let go of the smoke.
Better?
Yeah. Again? He hesitated, but I gave him my steely look, and he took a toke, a really big one, and smiled at me as he did it. I got ready for him to blow it to me, and maybe because I was already getting high, the exchange lasted 1,000 years. I looked at his pursed mouth and noticed it was pink and plump, and there were sprouts of new beard coming in on his chin. The smoke left his mouth, and I sucked it in, and sucked it in, and sucked it in, deeper and deeper and deeper. And then I fell sideways, holding my breath as well as I could. And only when it was completely impossible to hold it another second did I breathe out in a big gasp.
That a girl, he said,
his voice low and approving. I rolled over onto my back, my hands on my ribcage, the sparkling, bright stars looking 20 times larger. Dylan fell down beside me, and we just lay there, side by side, looking at the sky and letting the wind move over us for a long, long time.
Dude, you got me high.
You were having a panic attack, he said mildly. So that makes it medicine.
I giggle.
I'm not kidding.
But he laughed too, then slowed.
Now you have something to tell on me about, so you can trust me.
I turned my head, and his eyes were right there, pale and bright as moonlight, never eyes like a real person. You have mermaid eyes.
I wish I was a merman. That would be pretty cool.
He turned his head back to the sky, and I used my finger to draw the outline of his profile in the air.
Might get lonely, though.
Might.
He waited a long time before he said,
You're not going to tell me, are you?
I touched each of three scars on his upper arm, all three burns.
Did somebody burn you with a cigarette?
Cigar, he said. What if you don't have to say it, and I just guess?
Why do you want to know so bad? It was awful, but it's over. I'm good.
You're not, though.
He brushed my hair off my forehead.
You're sad all the time, and doing things that aren't really appropriate for your age.
I don't know what you mean.
I know. But if I tell you that it would feel good to talk to somebody, you need to believe me.
Talk to somebody? Like a counselor?
I looked up, horrified.
You can just tell me.
But I couldn't. I knew he would tell. No one but me could keep a secret this big. On the big pantry at Sapphire House, the memory rips through me. I suddenly miss Dylan so much, it feels like a fresh wound. Sinking to the cold linoleum, I wrap my arms around my knees and let the tears fall. I think now of my barely pubescent self having anxiety attacks and smoking pot to quell them, and wonder again, what the hell? Why didn't he tell my parents, no matter how angry I would be? But I also loved him so very, very much. He would have said his first loyalty was to his promise to me. In his own scarred way, he was trying to protect me. Dylan, Dylan, Dylan. So lost, so wrong, so misguided. But all three of the Bianchi women tried to save him. None of us could. In fact, I did the exact opposite.
Because of me,
Dylan died.
Chapter 19, Kit. By 10 the next morning, the cyclone has pushed through, leaving behind a glittery, humid morning. Javier doesn't linger. I have an interview, he says, leaning over the bed to kiss me where I still sprawl. Are you free tonight? His hair catches the sunlight, and for the first time, I see that it isn't black at all, but a very warm brown. I brush my fingertips through it and tell myself I should say no, but I can't find the discipline. And anyway, one of the hallmarks of a great holiday romance is the immersion factor. I'll have to check my calendar, I joke, but I imagine I'll be here. Good. Someone told me there's a very good Israeli restaurant nearby. Would you like to try it? Absolutely. He straightens, tucking in his shirt. What will you do today? More surfing? I'm going to run down some ideas I had about finding my sister. He buttons his shirt sleeves, and I find myself wondering if I've ever slept with a man who owned a long-sleeve Oxford shirt, with crisp lines down the arms from ironing. Are you sure you wish to find her? I tuck the covers over myself more firmly. No. But I have to follow it through now. I looked for her yesterday. I frown. What? He inclines his head. Miguel has lived here a long time now. He had good ideas. I sit up.
You told Miguel about her?
Not so much, only that you were looking for someone.
That's my business, Javier. I only shared it with you because we were... I struggle with why and give an exasperated sound. That was very invasive of you. He seems unconcerned.
The good news is, he thought he recognized her.
I don't care. This is my business, not yours. As if he doesn't even hear me, he picks up my phone from the side table and hands it to me.
Take my phone number, and then send yours to me.
I glare at him. Who do you think you are? Finally, he inclines his head.
Are you angry, Gatita? I only meant to help you.
For a long moment, I only look at him, feeling invaded and upset and tangled, and yet still so very drawn to him. I'm not the kind of woman who likes to be shuttled along by a man.
I did not intend.
Please don't get in my business like that. He sinks down beside me, tucks my hair behind my ear.
Don't be angry.
I am, though. I slap his hand, which makes him laugh. He tries to catch it, fails.
Sorry.
I'm not kidding. Do you understand?
Yes, I swear.
He holds up his hand, palm out.
I will not help you again.
Relenting, I pick up my phone and punch in the numbers he gives me, then call the phone so he'll have mine. It rings on the table in the kitchen. There you go. He smiles at me, the expression slow and appreciative.
Tonight, then.
I turn on my side to watch him go. My body is soft from making love, a delicious laziness in my spine. When he pauses at the door, I lift a hand to wave, and he blows a kiss. Ridiculous and lovely. I know better than to get mixed up with a charmer, to let down my guard, and yet, it's limited by circumstances. I'm safe enough. I roll over to look at the harbor. The water shines an opalescent deep blue. No sailboats this morning, but a sturdy-looking barge makes its way toward the open sea. Closer in, the offices are coming alive, and I watch a woman in a dark blue pencil skirt bustle from her office into the hallway, then pop up in an office a little farther down the way. What would it be like to live her life, I wonder? A person who works in an office, at a desk, wearing fancy clothes, in Auckland? Not my life at all. I don't miss the ER, but it has been only a few days. I haven't had much time to consider what else I might do, what kind of medicine might be calling me next, or if anything is calling me. It's possible that what I'm doing right now is giving me a chance to recharge my batteries. If not for Hobo, I'd volunteer with services like the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders, maybe the Peace Corps. But I can't leave Hobo. Speaking of my cat, I need to call my mother. Tossing off the covers, I pad naked into the shower, then dress and make a pot of coffee. As it brews, I text her to see if she's free to FaceTime. She rings in on my tablet almost immediately. Hi, sweetheart, she says, and moves the camera to show me a little black face poking out from beneath my bed. Look, Hobo, it's your mama. Hi, baby, I coo. He lets go of a pitiful, squeaky meow. Oh no, I don't know if it's good that he hears me. Blink at him, Suzanne orders. That's cat language for I love you. I know that, but how did you know it?
I looked it up.
You did? Pierced, I realize that she's taking this very seriously. Her devotion to the task slides beneath my defenses, reveals how much my mother has changed. She carries the tablet closer to the bed, and Hobo stays where he is, making that same pitiful little meep. Hey, Hobo, I say, and give him a slow blink. You're safe, and I love you, okay? He stares at the screen as if suspecting a trick, then skitters backward,
hiding behind the drop of the bedspread. Suzanne's face comes back on camera. He's okay, honey, just scared. This is the only creature who's ever depended on me, and I'm letting him down. Is he eating? Not as much as I'd like. He must come out when I'm gone, because he's using the litter box. But he doesn't come out when I'm here. I put his food by the bed, and he eats it when I'm out. So I've been filling a plate in the morning and then going for a walk. Poor hobo. Oh my God, I feel terrible. Don't, my mother says firmly. I'm taking good care of him. He's healthy and safe. You promise he's eating. I swear, Kit. She raises a long-fingered hand in an oath. I swallow, feeling a strange welling of gratitude and softness. Thank you, Mom. She waves a hand. Now tell me, what's happening with you? Any leads? No, but I do have some ideas. Good. I have to say, sweetheart, that it's doing you some good to get away. You have color in your cheeks. I try very hard not to allow more color to seep into my face, forcing an offhand smile. I went surfing yesterday, and it made me wonder why I haven't done more travel like that, you know? I mean, why not? You should. I could get you rooms at any of the Norhall hotels anywhere in the world. She works as a concierge at the one in Santa Cruz. Maybe you should do some of that yourself. Her slim shoulders twitch. I think I feel safer with my routines. She twirls the most recent of her AA chips between her fingers, over and over. Mom, you've been sober a long time. But you know, I bet they even do sober tours these days. Yeah, we'll see, she says. But I know it's a dismissal. Do you like it there? It's amazing. I carry my tablet over to the window. We had the edge of a cyclone go through last night, and everything is pretty quiet. But look at that view. It seems like the kind of place your sister would love, don't you think? Something about that comment irks me, and I turn the camera back to my face. I guess. What are you planning for today? I'm going to call surf shops, I say. I don't know why I didn't think of it before. No way she'd give up surfing. If she was still herself, I agree. But what if she had amnesia or something? I frown. I guess it's possible. Not that likely. You see it in books and TV all the time. And why else would she leave us to grieve her like that? Because she was selfish? Because she was an alcoholic and an addict? Thousands of miles away, in my own little house, my mother sits at my table and gazes calmly, steadily through the camera at me. This is what Josie will look like in 25 years. The graying blonde hair, the high cheekbones, the full lips that have thinned only a little with time. Or maybe, she offers, she was lost, broken. Poor Josie, I say with sharpness. You know, I was thinking about the way she drank when she was only 11 or 12, stealing sips from everyone, getting smashed. Why didn't you stop her? Suzanne has the grace to look away. Her rich voice rasps a bit as she says, "Honestly, kitten, I never even noticed. By then, I was pretty much drunk all the time myself." The frankness pokes a needle through the balloon of my self-righteousness. I know, I'm sorry. I just keep going over things, wondering why she got so bad so young. With a visceral sense of loss, I remember how it felt as she slipped away from me, as if she had really become a mermaid and lived most of the time beneath the waves. It was the start of my great loneliness, and the memory is so painful even now that I have to shove it away. She was so lost. Yes, my mother says. It's the way she listens now, acknowledging without embroidery. But it irks me a little anyway. It was a terrible environment. Obviously, I snap. But we also had Dylan. He looked out for us. Yeah, she says in a droll voice. A kid himself, and an addict. Her eyes suddenly fill with a terrible sorrow. He was always a lost boy, our Dylan. I did him no favors. What happened to him, Mom, before he came to us? I don't know. He'd clearly been abused physically for a long time. That's all I knew. He never said. She wiggles her fingers in front of the bedspread, where a furry black paw shows. I should have... She shakes her head, looks at me. My heart aches. Yeah. We can't change the past. I take a breath, shake my shoulders. You're right. I'm going to start calling surf shops and then maybe get out and do some sightseeing. There's a bus tour that goes up north that sounds really great. Good. Enjoy yourself. Kiss my cat when you can, okay? And you might get some more straight tuna. See if he eats that better. He'll be okay, kid. Promise. Thanks, Mom. Love you, sweetheart. I nod, giving her an open wave before I hang up. Mad at myself for not returning the endearment. She's been so good for so long, but I still have trouble letting her in. What does that say about me? At 10, I start phoning surf shops, and on the third one, I hit pay dirt. Hi, my name is Kit Bianchi, and I'm hoping to find a friend of mine who moved here a few years back. Sure, love. She's very pretty, blonde, great surfer, but the thing you'd remember is that she has a big, distinctive scar through her eyebrow. Oh, sure, that's Mari Edwards. Comes here all the time. I reckon I'll lose her now she's bought Sapphire House, but she's always been too rich for our blood over here. It takes 2 seconds for the words to fully sink in, and then I'm scrambling to write the name down. Mary as in M-A-R-Y? No, she spells it with an I, M-A-R-I. Don't suppose you have a phone number? Can't say I do, but you'll find her right enough. Married to Simon Edwards, him who runs the Phoenix Clubs. Clubs like nightclubs? Ha! No, no. Mari's a teetotaler. And old Simon's known for being the fittest man in Auckland. They're health clubs. You can see his ads on the telly. Wow, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. No worries. I hang up and type the name into Google. Mari Edwards. It comes back with thousands of hits. Most mention her only in relation to Simon Edwards, but there are a handful of photos of her. My sister, nearly always pictured with a tall, dashingly handsome man. The rare photos of the entire family show a boy and a girl, everyone hale and athletic. In one, they're all wearing wetsuits, surfboards at their sides. A rush of cold and heat bursts through my body, running under my skin, making my heart race. She's recreated the Tofino fantasy. When we were 10 or 11 and things got so bad between our parents, Josie and I made up a family who lived in British Columbia. We'd seen a TV special on Tofino, a town on the west coast of Vancouver Island, known for enormous January waves, and all three of us, Dylan included, were madly in love with the idea of going there. In our fantasy, the mom was a teacher and a swim coach, and the dad went to the office. Every summer, they took vacations in the car, driving down the coast, singing songs and eating in diners. They had an Airstream, and everybody loved surfing, so they always surfed together, wherever they went. That was our real family, we said. We were only staying here at Eden because our parents were spies and had to finish up one last job. They'd be back for us as soon as they were done. Josie, Mari, and her family looked just like the one we made up. A sense of rage rockets through me. How did my loser sister, the druggie and alcoholic who stole everything I owned at a time I could barely feed myself, land on her feet like this, when I am, what,
Alone. I am alone, with no family, no children, no husband. I leap up from the table and whirl around aimlessly, spun in circles by fresh fury. I want to throw something, break something, scream. She let us think she was dead, and she's fine. More than fine. Lava burns and gurgles in my gut, threatening to erupt. Get a hold of yourself. I yank open the sliding glass door to the balcony and step out, gripping the rail with tight fists. I take in a long breath, tasting sea and city, humid greenery and exhaust. I close my eyes and breathe out. The rage eases, leaving behind the most profound urge to sob. But I observe this too and let it go. I open my eyes and focus on the view, objectively noticing the flash of car windows crossing the Long Harbor Bridge and a barge passing beneath it. Foot traffic moves on the streets below my perch. Miniature human figures dressed up in miniature human clothes. Had I wished to find her in dire straits? Do I wish her ill? Why am I mad over her beautiful little family? I don't know, but I am. Slapping the tears away, I go back to the computer and slide my finger over the trackpad to bring the photo up again. She has children, my niece and nephew, my mother's grandchildren. She looks healthy, happy. Restlessly, I click back to the search results and see a local news video, filmed only the day before. Hard in my throat, I click on it. And there is Josie, in the foyer of a beautiful house, giving an interview. Tears spring to my eyes and spill over my face without permission. I turn up the sound, and there is her long-lost voice, a little raspy, edged now with a hint of an accent, not entirely New Zealand, but no longer entirely American. The sound of it burns, but I watch every second of the video, captured by my sister as she leads the reporter through the house, showing off the wood and the view and the bedroom where a film star from the 30s was murdered. She is still beautiful. Her hair is cut much shorter than I've ever seen it, to her shoulders, and it swings in that elegance of well-tended perfection. In person, age shows on her face. All those years in the full sun, in the wind and the surf, all the hard drinking, have given her skin a weathered look, a netting of crow's feet around her eyes. A man comes up in the frame, the same man from the photos, and slides a comfortable arm around her shoulders. He's stunningly good-looking, with thick brown hair and the kind of tan only an outdoorsman sports. The look of adoration he rains down upon her makes my stomach ache. Abruptly, I click it off. In comparison, my life suddenly looks very thin, thin and wan and lonely.
Chapter 20. Mari. I bring a box full of the Coalport cups and saucers back to Gwyneth, who will go nuts for them. I text her to make sure she's not overwhelmed with a project, and stop by her house before I go home. She answers the door in an adorable 30s-inspired romper made of black and white striped linen. Her hair is pulled back into a messy bun, and there isn't a scrap of makeup on her face. "Have you been hiking Machu Picchu or something?" she asks, holding the door for me. "You look beat." "Thanks, sweetheart. You look amazing, too." I park the box on the table and kiss her cheek. "I didn't sleep much last night." "It was quite a storm," she agrees. "Laura slept with me." Her house is a beautifully restored Victorian, with antiques and period-specific artwork on the walls. Today, the overhead fan is going full speed, but it's hot. "Still against air conditioning? I think I might put it in at Sapphire House." "No, no!" She waves her hands like windshield wipers. "You'll ruin the lines." "I'm sure there's a way to do it without ruining the aesthetics." She humps. "Air conditioning is a scourge."
or one of the greatest blessings of mankind.
Come into the kitchen. I'll make us some lemonade.
It's bright and lovely, and I seat myself at the table overlooking the harbor, while Gwen drops ice onto glasses. I know the lemonade will be fresh squeezed and almost too tart, and utterly perfect. That's one of her specialties. She brings over two frosty tall glasses and sets one in front of me.
So, how's the house?
I'm sorry I couldn't come this weekend, but I figured you'd want some family time anyway. It's going well. I just brought you a few bits of china to look over. I thought you might like it.
I saw you on TV.
Great job. My stomach flips.
It's already on? They just filmed it.
Well, it's not like they have to do anything but upload it. It's a good story.
You told it Will.
I nod, taking a big gulp of the, yes, almost painfully tart lemonade.
Maybe someone will come forward with some kind of clue about the murder.
Doubtful, really. I don't know. Maybe they've been afraid of hurting someone or getting hurt themselves. Something like that.
She shrugs. I suppose it's possible.
Right. I found some of the sisters' journals, actually.
Oh, can I read them?
Not yet. I dug out my old notes and remembered that there had been talk about the carpenter who did all the inlays. Gossip that he and Veronica had a thing.
It's outrageously great work, I say, reaching into my bag to pull out the notebook I always carry, now with my fountain pen.
Oh, is that new?
I grin, holding it up.
You like?
I almost say, my sister and I had this thing for fountain pens, but clamp my mouth closed just in time.
What's wrong? Gwyneth asks. You look like you swallowed a fly.
Just thought of something I forgot at the market.
Unscrewing the top of the pen, I flip to a clean page.
Okay, I say. I'll check it out.
You all right?
Just tired.
I rub my aching temples.
Maybe I ought to just go home and catch a nap before the family returns.
The house is blissfully cool and empty when I get back. The dogs and I trot upstairs, where I draw the curtains and stretch out on the bed, my mind full of Gwyneth's speculations. Paris posts herself right beside me, and I reach out to soothe her, running my fingers through the ruff under her chin, which makes her groan ever so softly. On my laptop, I open the file I've been assembling about the murder and the history of the house. In one file is a group of photos I've captured from the internet. Veronica in the sizzling gown that launched her career. George with his medals, looking solid and powerful and very hot, like a young Jason Momoa. I don't have a photo of Helen, and I search for one but come up with only three. With her sister and George just after the house was finished. As a girl somewhere in the bush, her hair natural and flying in the wind, and a few years before her death, at some kind of fundraiser. By then, she was polished and stately, her hair smoothed back into a snowy French twist, her warm skin beautifully offset by an aqua dress. Not a beauty like her sister, but good-looking enough. In the one with George, he had one arm around her and one around Veronica, and he was grinning as they both leaned into him. It made me think, unexpectedly, of Dylan and Kit and me, and I have to shove the vision away. Helen, George, and Veronica were all Maori, enjoying a level of wealth and celebrity that would have been rare for anyone, but maybe was even more notable for Maoris at the time.
Huh.
I make a note to read more about the celebrity romance. What did they say? How did they talk about George and Veronica? But also, sisters. That could be a very fraught relationship, as I well know. Could Helen have had a thing for George or he for her? Naughty George, if so, cheating on his wife, then cheating on his mistress. But once a cheater, always a cheater in my book. Men who cheated kept cheating. Like my father. The first time I figured out that one of the hostesses was having sex with my dad, I was 8. I'd been out on the beach, but cut my toe on a rock and raced up to Eden to get band-aids. My dad was in the empty bar, making out with Yolanda, the weekend hostess. They jumped up when I slammed into the room and I just glared at them. I cut my toe. My dad made Yolanda bandage my toe, and I could tell she didn't want to. Her lipstick was all smeared, looking stupid, and she seemed like she was about to cry. "Don't tell your mom, okay?" she said. "I really need this job."